The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Welcome to Science for the People. Today we're exploring the edge between the possible and the impossible in the world of complex computing. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. A little later on, we'll talk to Lance Fortnow, professor and chair of the School of Computer Science at the Georgia Institute of Technology, about his new book, The Golden Ticket, P, NP, and the Search for the Impossible. But first, I'll welcome Scott Aronson to the show. Scott is an associate professor of electrical engineering and computer science at MIT. His research focuses on the capabilities and limits of quantum computers and on the connections between computational complexity and physics. He is well known for his blog and for founding Complexity Zoo, an online encyclopedia of complexity cases. He's written about quantum computing for Scientific American and the New York Times, has written the book Quantum Computing Since Democritus, and has received awards for excellence in teaching. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So when did people first start thinking about quantum computing?
Well, the idea goes back to the 80s or even earlier when physicists like Richard Feynman and David Deutsch started noticing that if you want to simulate quantum mechanics, so let's say, you know, a chemistry problem, a nuclear physics problem, you want to simulate it on a conventional computer, it seems incredibly inefficient because the basic equations of quantum mechanics have this exponentiality built into them, where like with each new particle you add, the size of the quantum states, the number of numbers that your computer has to store to keep track of what's happening, doubles. So, you know, there might be four numbers for two particles, and then eight numbers for three particles, 16 numbers for four particles, and so forth. And then with 1,000 particles, you would need more numbers than there are atoms in the universe to have a full description. So this, you know, had been sort of understood ever since the founding of quantum mechanics itself in the 1920s. And it had been seen as a practical problem. You know, it's what makes it so tough to solve the equations of quantum mechanics on a classical computer, and, you know, why we have to resort to all sorts of approximations and heuristics in practice. So the great insight that Feynman and Deutsch and the others had was that, well, maybe we could turn this around. Maybe we could turn these lemons into lemonade, right? And if quantum mechanics is so hard to simulate with our existing computers, then why don't we build computers that themselves would take advantage of the same exponentiality of the quantum world, that themselves would use the same quantum effects? Supposing that we could build such a computer, call it a quantum computer, we then faced the question, what would it be good for? Unfortunately, Feynman and Deutsch were not yet able to suggest, you know, a very good answer to that question. The best that they could suggest was, if you like, sort of the obvious thing, such a computer would be good for simulating quantum mechanics. Okay, you could have a general purpose programmable computer that you could use to simulate whatever quantum system you wanted. So it would be like, you know, in the old days, you know, every time people wanted to simulate turbulence around an airplane wing, they would have to build a new wind tunnel, right? And today they just have a single machine, a computer that they program to you know, simulate whatever specific system they want. So a quantum computer would be sort of a general purpose quantum simulator. That was the original idea. And to tell you the truth, if we ever get practical quantum computers, I think that will be the most important application of them still. But what really got people excited about this field, what really sort of launched it as a field rather than just a sort of like a crazy idea that a few people were thinking about, was that in the 1990s it was discovered that a quantum computer could also do other things. In particular, there are some purely classical problems that a quantum computer could solve much, much faster than we know how to solve them with a classical computer. The most famous example of that is finding the prime factors of enormous numbers. So Peter Shor discovered in 1994 that a quantum computer would also be able to solve this problem much, much faster than we know how to solve it with today's computers. Now, this is important because if you've ever ordered something from Amazon or from eBay or whatever, your web browser protects your credit card number with a code whose security depends on, you know, huge numbers being difficult to factor. You know, this belief in the hardness of factoring is sort of the engine that fuels almost all of modern encryption. And what Shor showed is that if you could build a quantum computer, then that's no longer true. So, you know, naturally that got a lot of people excited about it, and that, you know, really turned it from a speculative idea into a question of, what would it take to actually build this thing?
So what is the actual difference between a quantum computer and a conventional computer?
So a quantum computer, you know, the easiest way to say it is that it's a computer that would exploit quantum mechanics. You know, that, of course, that just punts the question. Now I have to explain, you know, what is quantum mechanics all about, right? And almost any popular article that you read about this subject, you know, takes a sort of lazy way out. And what it says is that a quantum computer is just like a conventional computer, except it's massively parallel. Whereas, you know, a conventional bit is either 0 or 1, a quantum bit, or a qubit, as we call it, is both 0 and 1 at the same time somehow. So, you know, whereas a classical computer has to try each possible answer one by one, a quantum computer can somehow explore all of the answers in parallel. Well, you know, that would be great, you know, if it were true, but it sort of sounds too good to be true, and it kind of is. So let me try to explain what's really going on here. So, you know, the idea of a quantum computer is sort of exploring all the possible states at the same time, all the possible answers at the same time, you know, has some sort of connection to the truth. But the problem is that, you know, at some point you've got to measure your computer to get an answer out. And what quantum mechanics predicts is that when you make a measurement, you know, you're just going to get a random answer, you know, with some probability that you can calculate. Okay, so then, you know, you might say, you know, if I'm just getting a random outcome when I make a measurement, then saying that the computer is trying all of these possible solutions at once, you know, is just a really fancy way of, you know, a convoluted way of saying, well, it's just trying one of them, and we don't know which one, and we'll find out when we look at the thing. Okay, in which case we sort of jump to the other extreme, which is that, you know, this would not be giving us any benefit at all. Here's what most of the popular articles will not tell you, but I will. I'll let you in on the secret. The key point of quantum mechanics, the thing that makes it different from what we're used to in the classical world, is that the way that you calculate the probability of something happening is completely different in quantum mechanics than what we're used to. In ordinary life, you know, we might talk about a 20% or 30% chance of rain tomorrow. We'd never talk about a negative 20% chance of rain, right? That would just be stupid.
That would be weird.
Okay. In quantum mechanics, that by itself doesn't make any sense either. But it turns out that if you want to find the what's the chance that something will happen, you have to add up a whole bunch of numbers called amplitudes. Sort of one for every way that the thing could happen. And crucially, amplitudes don't have to be positive. They can also be negative. Okay, in fact, they can even be complex numbers, you know, imaginary numbers like the square root of minus one. Okay, the key point is that if something like, let's say, a photon hitting a certain point on a screen, if that could happen one way with a positive amplitude and another way with a negative amplitude, then the two ways that it could have happened can, as we say, interfere destructively and cancel each other out, so that then, in fact, you'll never find the photon there at all. Okay, so this is what's seen, for example, in the famous double slit experiment, right, where you shine light at a screen with two slits in it, and you find that there are these dark fringes where a photon never appears. Now, what's bizarre is that if you close off one of the slits, then the photon can appear at that place. So in other words, decreasing the number of ways for something to happen can actually increase the chance that it will happen in quantum mechanics, okay, because you are then, you know, getting rid of the destructive interference. Hey, and this is really the one trick of quantum mechanics that just gets sort of repeated over and over and over again, right? And everything else you've heard about, you know, quantum entanglement and Schrodinger's cat and Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, all just sort of different logical consequences of this one change to the rules of probability themselves. Okay, and in particular, this is true of quantum computers. So a quantum computer, you can think about it as this double slit experiment writ large. So the idea of it is to arrange a gigantic pattern of interference where for each wrong answer, you know, there will be a whole bunch of contributions to its amplitude, but they'll be sort of pointing in random directions. So some will be positive, some will be negative, and on the whole, they'll mostly cancel each other out. Okay, whereas for the right answer, you want all of the amplitudes to be in phase with each other. So all the different paths that your system could take to get to the right answer, you want them to, say, all have positive amplitude or all have negative amplitude. Now, you know, if you can arrange that, then when you make a measurement of your computer, the right answer will be observed with high probability. You know, and if it's not observed, then you can just run the computer again until it is. Okay, now this is a very subtle effect. You know, this is, you know, you can see why it wasn't obvious to people in the 80s that this would actually be good for anything. You know, and it took a great series of great discoveries in the 1990s to realize that for a few specific problems, like factoring large numbers, you actually can choreograph this pattern of interference. You know, you can do it despite, you know, not knowing in advance what the prime factors are, you know, which would make it trivial, of course, right? But you can, despite not knowing the prime factors, you can set up a pattern, you can do a physical experiment that will set up a pattern of quantum interference that sort of concentrates all of this amplitude on the correct prime factors. So that was, you know, an amazing thing, right? But it's not anything as simple as just trying all of the prime factors in parallel, right? It's really much more subtle than that. And it really, you know, took advantage of very special properties of this problem of factoring large numbers so that, you know, already for other sorts of problems, like finding the shortest route for a traveling salesman, there, you know, even with a quantum computer, we don't know how to do it efficiently. So, you know, even quantum computers look like, you know, they would have limitations. And it's really only for certain special things that we know how to get this magical speed up.
So that sounds very different than conventional computing. So what does a sort of modern day quantum computer, and I'm using air quotes, look like?
So there are a lot of ideas being explored right now about how to actually implement quantum computers, right? What I told you before is the theory. But, you know, just like with classical computers, right, you know, you can be like a virtuoso programmer despite, you know, knowing nothing about what's going on, you know, inside of the CPU case, you know, having no idea of the physics of how a transistor works. Right, because it's just a different level of abstraction. Okay, the same thing is true with quantum computers. So, you know, we develop the theory based only on, you know, the laws of quantum physics, you know, which have been sort of, you know, the core of physics for almost 100 years. So we develop the theory, but, you know, then there's the question, okay, what actual physical system, you know, can you find that will sort of implement this theory? And, you know, there are, you know, a lot of different proposals which sort of all realize, you know, or all, you know, the goal of all of them would be to realize this same theoretical picture. One of the furthest along proposals is called ion traps. So you would take ions, you would suspend them in a trap using a magnetic field, and the spin state of the ion, so whether it's like spinning in one direction or another direction, that would be your zero or your one. That would be your qubit. Okay, and you know, what's important is that when you get down to the small enough scale, any physical property at all that can be in either a zero state or a one state can also be in a superposition of those two states. And so what you would need to do, you'd need to be able to get sort of any pair of ions that you would like to interact with each other. Okay, so you need to be able to do the quantum version of logic gates. Right, in your classical computer, if you go to a small enough scale, what you'll see is basically logic gates, like and or not, you know, operations that work on only one or two bits at a time. And that, you know, they'll say this bit should be on if and only if these other two bits are both on, something like that. Okay, so a quantum computer would be much the same. You know, you have to build it out of these very, very simple building blocks. Quantum operations that just act on one or two of the qubits at a time. Okay, but you know, you have to be able to arrange all that. So with ion traps, you would move the ions around with lasers, is the idea, and sort of, you know, in order to bring, you know, two ions of your choice close to each other and, you know, and get them to interact with each other just by, you know, electromagnetic interaction. And nature dictates to you how the particles will interact. But then, you know, using that as your sort of building block, you have to, you know, engineer the specific sort of interaction that you want in order to do your computation. So that's one idea. Another idea is what's called superconducting qubits. So these are on a much larger scale. You know, these are actually, you know, coils that are sometimes even like big enough that you can see them with a magnifying glass. But they're cooled to close to absolute zero so that a current through the coil becomes superconducting, okay? And it turns out that it can then be in a quantum superposition of flowing clockwise and flowing counterclockwise. Okay, and this involves, you know, billions of electrons, amazingly. But okay, but again, you know, you've now have your qubit. Okay, and then you need to get pairs of these coils to interact with each other. So that's another proposal. A third proposal is to use photons, use the polarization states of photons for your qubits. You know, photons are great because they sort of preserve their quantum properties, you know, extremely well. Right, so you may have heard that quantum states are very, very fragile. This is sort of what makes it so hard to build a quantum computer. Okay, but you know, photons, some of them have reached us, you know, since the early universe, you know, having maintained their quantum states for billions of years of, you know, traveling through space. Okay, the problem is that, you know, photons, of course, don't like to sit still. They're, you know, they sort of fly away at the speed of light. And, you know, they also don't really like to talk to each other. So you have to do something to make the photons interact with each other. Anyway, you know, those are, you know, there are also more exotic proposals, but those are three of the most common ones people talk about. I would say that it's not yet clear, you know, which proposal is going to be the best. So, you know, in classical computing, right, there were also lots of different ideas, you know, analog computing, digital computing. You know, eventually the transistor was invented in the 1940s, and it was just so much better than everything else that it just dominated the industry. And I would say that we don't yet have the quantum computing analog of the transistor. You know, we're still looking for the technology that will really solve all of the problems, right, in building these things. You know, each of the proposals that I talked about has sort of complementary, you know, strengths and weaknesses, and we don't yet know sort of what's going to be the best way forward. That's why people are sort of exploring all of them in parallel.
This is Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders, and I'm here discussing quantum computing with Scott Aronson, associate professor at MIT. We'll be right back with more Science for the People right after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You are tuned in to Science for the People. We've got Scott Aronson with us today, Associate Professor of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science at MIT, and we're talking about the world of quantum computing, what progress has been made, and how the subject is discussed in mainstream media. So I want to talk a little bit about D-Wave, because yep. When you see quantum computing in the news these days, it's all mm-hmm. about D-Wave. Yep. Can you give us sort of a really quick overview of who they are and what they do?
D-Wave is a company which is based in a suburb of Vancouver, and so they've sort of come to dominate the popular coverage of quantum computing, you know, in recent years. because they claim to already have practical quantum computers, right? And they've sold, you know, two of these things, whatever they are, right? They've sold one of them to Lockheed Martin and the other one to a consortium of Google and NASA. You know, so they have their latest model has 512 qubits roughly, and you know, you can it's designed just for one specific task, which is called adiabatic optimization. Okay, so even by D-Wave's own account, okay, this is not a what's called a universal quantum computer. It's not like a quantum computer that you can program to do whatever you want. In particular, it's not useful at all for factoring large numbers, which was sort of the, you know, the killer app that got people excited about quantum computing in the first place, you know, or for quantum simulations for that matter. Okay, it's useful for exactly, you know, according to D-Wave's account, for exactly one thing, which is trying to solve these sort of combinatorial optimization problems, right, where you have a whole bunch of constraints, you know, you're trying to satisfy as many of them as possible. So like, let's say, you know, you're an airline, you're trying to schedule your flights, you know, you have all these constraints, right, and you want to get a schedule that does sort of as well as possible. You know, and there is a quantum algorithm that you can attempt to use for those sorts of problems. It's called the adiabatic algorithm. You know, it was first proposed by colleagues of mine at MIT, a group led by Ed Farhi 15 years ago. Now, the difficulty is this. It's that we also know how to, you know, we also know classical algorithms to attack these same problems. You know, in fact, we know classical algorithms that look a lot like this adiabatic algorithm. There's something called simulated annealing. You know, neither of these algorithms is sort of guaranteed to work, right? That, you know, there may be some sets of constraints where they just won't find a solution. Okay, you know, and again, D-Wave, you know, it sort of admits all of this. But, you know, both of them may work pretty well in practice. You know, so for, you know, the sorts of constraints that, you know, you see in real life, right, they may usually give you a solution, which is, you know, if not perfect, then good enough. Okay, now the key question here, and the key bone of contention that, you know, has made D-Wave so controversial and that people are arguing about is, well, okay, it's two things, actually. First of all, does this adiabatic approach ever really give you an advantage in, you know, in real life compared to what you could do with classical approaches? Okay, and it is not at all clear to us that it does. Okay, now on top of that is a second difficulty, you know, that D-Wave's current technology is actually very far from implementing, you know, this pure adiabatic algorithm. Okay, it's instead doing something much, much messier, if you like, and much, much closer to classical computing, which is called quantum annealing. So, you know, you could think of it as sort of being sort of like classical computation, but with a little bit of quantumness thrown in. Okay, and, you know, people are arguing about, you know, how much quantumness is there, how much quantum effects are there, right? But then, you know, on top of that, even if there are quantum effects there, they may not be playing a role in actually helping you solve the problem any faster than you could otherwise. You know, people keep asking me, so is it a quantum computer or isn't it? Right, and, you know, people want to have this binary yes or no, you know, way of classifying things, right? And so what I would say is that, you know, what D-Wave is doing sort of has the same relationship to quantum computing that, let's say, a dirty bomb would have to a nuclear weapon. Yes, it's really a bomb. Yes, it really explodes. Yes, it really, you know, spreads radioactive waste, you know, over the right. So it, you know, it really does involve some radioactive effects. Okay, but it's not really what we mean normally in talking about a nuclear weapon, right? And, you know, and it seems like it's inherently much more limited in power.
In the media, stories about D-Wave always sound super sci-fi. You hear things like 1,000 times faster and 150 times colder than interstellar space. That all sounds kind of magical.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, they've been, you know, you have to hand it to them that, you know, they've been, you know, unbelievably effective in sort of getting their story out to the media, you know, and to investors, you know, and to the business world, sort of, you know, without having really made the science case. you know, to the scientific community. You know, and you know, and part of it is just that you know, I think just as you were suggesting, right? Journalists like to hear these sound bites. You know, they don't always like to sort of dig into each one, right? So I could take them one by one. This 1,000 times faster. It was actually claimed that the D-Wave machine was 3,600 times faster than a classical computer in some speed test. Now, what was quickly realized after that was that this comparison, first of all, it was by a consultant, you know, who was hired by Google and NASA, who were like, you know, part of D-Wave's consortium, I guess. And what she was asked to do was just to compare the D-Wave machine against an off-the-shelf classical solver called CPLEX. You know, and indeed the D-Wave machine was a lot faster. Now what this was telling you was not that the D-Wave machine was fast, but that CPLEX was just completely the wrong software to use on your classical computer. You know, if you use better software on your classical computer, then it will outperform the D-Wave machine. So that was, you know, that was sort of quickly debunked, but, you know, but not, again, not before it had sort of spread out, you know, into the media and sort of a lot of people had accepted it as fact. You know, the coldest, you know, place in the universe, right? I mean, you know, that there was just a cover story in Time magazine, right? Who were the first paragraph was about how the coldest place in the universe, you know, is not in interstellar space. It's in this D-Wave's headquarters in Burnaby. You know, even if this were true, right, it's, you know, not really relevant to, you know, how fast is it solving the problem. Okay, but in fact, you know, it's cold, you know, it's so the temperature that they cool it to get it to superconduct is about 20 millikelvin. That is indeed quite cold. You know, it's 20 thousandths of a degree above absolute zero. Okay, but colder temperatures are routinely achieved in many, many other physics experiments. You know, so I've been sort of, you know, not really, you know, not because it's my favorite thing to do, maybe, but each time sort of some claim like this gets, you know, onto the news, onto the blogosphere, you know, people start asking me questions. And because I have this quantum computing blog that a few people read, you know, I feel compelled to respond to it. But, you know, it's been very much sort of reactive, very much trying to, you know, set the record straight, you know, after a lot of sort of damage has already been done and a lot of people have already gotten the wrong idea.
I know that for a long time, nobody could kind of get a look inside the D-Wave computer. Is that still true, or have non-D-Wave scientists been able to kind of crack it open?
That's an excellent question. So you're absolutely right that for a long time, you know, we didn't really know what was going on. We were just, you know, trying to infer, you know, and basically, you know, trying to make the point that, well, look, you know, they haven't proved anything, right? And that the burden of proof, you know, should not be on us. It should be on them. But, you know, but this sort of argument doesn't, you know, get you that far with most people. You know, now just within the last year or two, we have learned a lot more about the devices than we knew before. And the reason is that they sold two of them. You know, the one that Lockheed bought is installed at University of Southern California. And the one that Google bought is installed at NASA Ames Research Center. And so for the first time, independent groups have been doing experiments on these machines, and they've been publishing research papers with the results. So, you know, the most important, I think, was a group involving Matthias Troyer, Daniel Lidar, John Martinez, and some others, where they really tried to do, first of all, to figure out, are there, you know, quantum effects going on in this machine? What kinds of quantum effects? And second of all, to do performance comparison against classical computing. They found that there is some evidence for quantum effects, you know, in the machine. Now, you know, at sort of a local level, at sort of a level of sort of 2 or 3 or 4 qubits, it looks pretty clear that, you know, there's this characteristic quantum effect called entanglement in the machine. At sort of the global level, at sort of all 100 or all 500 of the qubits, we don't really know yet if entanglement is there or not. So the Troyer et al. Group said that, you know, they saw what looked like some sort of signature for quantum entanglement and for quantum effects, even at the global level, which would be, which by the way, would be a prerequisite to getting a quantum speed up. Okay, but you know, they claim to see some sort of signature for this global entanglement. Now, just very recently, there was another paper by Shin et al. Questioning that and saying, well, we have a classical model. We have a model with no global entanglement, but that can make the same predictions. So I would say that that's currently being disputed. Hopefully, we'll learn the truth before too long. But, you know, it looks like local entanglement, yes, global entanglement, maybe. So that's the first thing. But now the second thing is, okay, you know, we can argue about physics, you know, for a long time, but, you know, is it actually getting a speed up, right? Is it actually solving anything faster than a classical computer? And here it looks pretty unequivocal that the answer right now is no, that you can do just as well with your laptop. I'll say, you know, if it's appropriately programmed. You know, and not only is the machine sort of not doing better on any of the sort of problem sets that, that they tried out, but, you know, the scaling behavior doesn't look better either. Okay, so it doesn't look like, okay, it's just a matter of, you know, they only have 500 qubits, and, you know, once they get to 2,000 qubits or 10,000 qubits, then, you know, the curves will cross and then it will be better. You know, it's rather it's that both of the curves look exponential. It looks like no matter how many qubits you add, you know, that there's not going to be a speed up this way. You know, so in the face of this, you know, a lot of D-Wave supporters have, you know, I think sort of moved the goalposts a little. And they've said, well, of course, you know, you wouldn't expect to see a speed up today. You know, that's just silly. You know, of course, a year ago they were saying something different. Okay. But, you know, they say, well, look, you know, the point is just that, you know, we've got, you know, some quantum behavior. We've pried the door a little bit open. And now maybe we can find some problem where this machine does better. Right, or maybe we can improve the hardware, and maybe there will be a path forward to getting a speed up in the future. You know, I can't say that that's impossible, right? The future is a long time, you know, and a lot could happen. But, you know, what it looks like to us is that, you know, it's going to take sort of fundamentally better hardware than they have now, you know, to have a serious chance for a quantum speed up. So, you know, like I was saying before, right, what they're doing, you could see it as like very, very close to classical computing with sort of a little bit of quantumness thrown in. You know, it looks like at the very least you would need to sort of increase the amount of quantumness there, which, you know, in fact is what sort of academic labs all over the world, you know, have been trying to do, you know, for the last few decades. You know, D-Wave's approach has basically been to ignore that, right, to say, let's just take the qubits that we have now, you know, and throw hundreds of them together and see what happens. Right, which, you know, is, you know, in a way it's good for someone to try the experiment, but, you know, it looks like the results of the experiment are now coming in, and they're that, you know, you don't actually get a speed up this way. Right, so it's looking like you're going to need sort of higher quality qubits. You know, and even then, as I also said, we still don't know whether even then you're going to get a speed up using this adiabatic optimization approach. You know, it might be that quantum computers really only give you speed ups for more special types of problems like factoring large numbers.
So just to sort of close things off, if you are going yep. to leave some advice with the quantum computing enthusiast who is also a layperson when they're looking at kind of media reports of what's going on, mm-hmm. would you have any advice for them reading that information?
I would say, you know, don't be sort of bowled over just by, you know, claims, oh, you know, it's here and there at the same time. It's, you know, it's more powerful than, you know, than all the atoms in the universe, right? I mean, people, you know, especially the media loves to use this hyperbolic language in discussing quantum computing. Now, you know, in fact, you know, it is scientifically fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating enough that sort of I, you know, spend much of my career on it. Okay. But, you know, you have to come to it, you know, and furthermore, you know, I don't think, you know, one should go to the other extreme and say that it's all bunk, right? It looks like, you know, the possibility of doing this, you know, is a pretty solid consequence of the laws of quantum mechanics themselves, right? If you doubt that it's possible, then, you know, something is wrong with our current understanding of the laws of physics. And, you know, you could say that would be even much more exciting than quantum computing, right? Much more exciting than to succeed in building a quantum computer would be to fail, you know, because quantum mechanics is wrong. Okay. So, you know, it looks like that, you know, it should indeed be possible, you know, eventually. That doesn't mean in 5 years, but, you know, it means the laws of physics say that, you know, this should be possible, you know, if, let's say, if our civilization lasts long enough. It should give you speed ups for certain special problems, not necessarily for all problems, okay, but for, you know, a few things like factoring, you know, you really can exploit this interference effect to, you know, to do something quite incredible. But, you know, you have to, you know, this is an evolving area of science, and, you know, you have to sort of look at the claims with, you know, the same sort of skepticism that you would apply to anything else. You have to ask questions like, you know, if some group is, you know, reporting some experiment, right, what did they actually do? You know, if someone is claiming to get, you know, to have a practical quantum computer, well, okay, you know, in what sense is it practical? Does it actually outperform the best that we could do with a classical computer, for example? You know, and, you know, I think that, you know, there are some people who've managed to get very far by just banking on people not asking this sort of question.
Scott, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
If you want to learn more about Scott Aronson, you can find him at scottaronson.com, a link you'll find on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca in our show notes. We'll be back after the break with Lance Fortnow from the School of Computer Science at the Georgia Institute of Technology to talk about his new book, The Golden Ticket, P, NP, and the Search for the Impossible. So don't go away.
On the next episode of Science for the People, we're exploring the science of beauty products and procedures. We'll talk to cosmetic chemist Perry Romanowski, co-founder of TheBeautyBrains.com, about his book, It's Okay to Have Lead in Your Lipstick. And we'll speak to cosmetic surgeon Dr. Elizabeth Hall Findlay about plastic surgery tourism and safety regulation in the industry. That's next week on Science for the People, on your local radio station, or online at scienceforthepeople.ca.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Rochelle Saunders. I'm here with Lance Fortnow, professor and chair of the School of Computer Science of the College of Computing at the Georgia Institution of Technology. He received his PhD from MIT and held a professorship at Northwestern University and the University of Chicago before joining Georgia Tech. His research focuses on computational complexity, the theoretical study of efficient computation. He's here today to talk about his new book, The Golden Ticket, P, NP, and the Search for the Impossible. Welcome, Lance. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's jump right in and also kind of break this down. What is P, what is NP, and why is there a relation of interest to us?
P is just simply means the sort of kinds of problems that we can solve quickly on computers. So, for example, if you get into your car and you put into your GPS a certain location and it tries to find the shortest route for you to get from here to there, the number of possible routes that you have is incredibly enormous. Yet the computer is able to use an algorithm to very quickly figure out the absolute fastest route to get from one point to another. So that's that kind of problem. Finding the shortest route in the map is something that we can do very efficiently, and that's something that would be in this class called P. NP are problems where we're looking for a solution. We don't necessarily know whether we can find the solution quickly, but if we actually had it, we'd know it. Loads of examples of problems like this. One well-known one is if I take a map, and you can color any map with four colors, so that every neighboring countries have different colors. But what if you want to see if you can color this map with only three colors? And if I actually gave you a solution, it'd be easy to check. If I gave you a coloring, you could check that all the neighboring countries have different colors. But the number of possible colorings that you could try is enormous. And NP are the kinds of problems where if we had a solution, we could check the solution. It's very easy to check that the solution is correct, but it could be hard to find that solution. And so the P equals NP question is simply, is there every problem where we can check a solution? Can we also find it quickly?
Okay, so this is obviously an outstanding question, but what happens if P equals NP?
Right, so if we could make P equals NP, then we could actually find perfect algorithms to do things like language translation, predict the future of things like the weather or finance or just very complicated things. We could come up with very simple algorithms to do. And you could even potentially automate creativity. You could feed the algorithm examples of Beethoven symphonies and come up with a 10th symphony, for example, or finish Schubert's unfinished symphony, or create great works of art in whatever style you want, or create visuals that, you know, are identical that you would not be able to tell from, you know, true reality.
In the book, you take us on a highly speculative journey into a possible future where P equals NP. It's quite an interesting trip. So how much of that kind of idealized future P equals NP world was exaggeration versus what might really be possible?
Well, it's hard to say. Sort of the way that it's hard to predict what the effect of Facebook, you know, 10 years ago had on our lives today. And some of it is probably, so I did, I wrote this chapter called The Beautiful World. And I tried to come up with a view of what could happen, for example, that we could cure cancer, for example, because we could figure out how to design the right DNA sequences that created the right proteins that would attack an individual's cancer cells, leave all the other cells intact. There might be a few exaggerations. For example, I suggest we could predict the weather a year ahead of time. That might not happen if P equals NP. The weather's just too chaotic to predict. But I think for the most part, most of what I kind of suggest, you know, could actually be very possible. And honestly, I think things would probably change in ways I can't even imagine. Once you're able to sort of do anything you could imagine doing on a computer, which is basically what would happen if P equals NP, the number of possibilities, you know, is really just sort of limited by your imagination. There's a dark side to that as well. I think a huge loss in privacy. Because you can easily back on information that people are doing based on the actions that they do it with, if P equals NP. So you could almost entirely eliminate privacy. It would be hard to do a lot of cryptography if P equals NP, so it's hard to keep secrets. And since you could automate just about anything, the question is, what would people do? So it might cause a lot of problems in the job market beyond what you already see happening today.
So P versus NP is really, I guess, at its sort of core about effective or efficient computing. So we're talking about there are some things that even our supercomputers of today just can't compute?
That's right, right. So, you know, we talk a lot about P equals NP. The general belief is that they're different, is that these problems which seem hard to solve or really are hard to solve. So the PNP question really is saying is that there's a limit to what computers can do. There are just some challenges that seem so difficult that, you know, even if you had all the computers working together, just too many possibilities to check to get the best kind of answer. A good example I like to use is Facebook. Is what's the largest clique in Facebook, where a clique is a group of people who are all friends with each other? And it seems like an interesting question to ask. You can't really ask it unless you had access to Facebook's data, but suppose you worked at Facebook and had access to all of Facebook's data. The best way we know to find the largest clique is to try all the possibilities. And the number of possibilities for, say, 100 or 200 size clique is just way beyond the computational power of any machine now or in the future. So it just seems that there are just going to be some problems that, in general, we're just not going to be able to come up with the best solutions for. And so I spent a lot of time in the book just saying, well, how do we tackle these problems anyway? There's lots of, you know, we can do some approximation or heuristics or tricks like that, but to actually always be able to find the right solution just might not be possible.
So this question sort of first came to prominence in the 70s, I believe. So how have advances in computing power over the last 20, 30 years affected this problem or potentially not really affected this problem?
I think it's affected it in both ways. I like to compare 1971, which was the year that the first paper on PNP was published by a Canadian, Steve Cook, was also the first year the first microprocessor that Intel put out. And if you look at the speed of computing from those days to these days, you know, it's an order of millions or billions times faster now than it was back then. So what has that done to the PNP problem? Well, first of all, it means that for some moderate size NP problems, you can actually search all the possibilities, and computers are just that fast. So if you want to, say, color a map with 50 countries in it, you can just, you know, with a little bit of intelligence, you could probably do that relatively quickly. But what it also has done is it's created a thirst for more. The fact that we have faster computers means we are also creating more data. So the amount of data that we have to deal with now is just tremendous, the amount of data that gets generated from scientific experiments, from social networks, from all sorts of communication. It's just enormous, the amount of data that's out there. And now we're looking for ways to try to understand that data. And so we're asking questions now that even the PNP is even playing a larger role trying to understand these questions. We're asking about enormous amounts of data. And PNP is kind of telling us what the limitations of the kinds of questions we can ask and try to answer.
These days, we don't just put one supercomputer against a problem. We quite often sort of put a bunch at the same problem in parallel. Does that affect our level of, or the PNP problem?
It does to an extent. You're right. Computers sort of stopped getting faster around 2005 for power reasons. So instead of computers getting faster, what we've had to do is make computers work together, either putting by lots of chips on a single board and as in multi-core machines, or by having lots of different computers working together in the cloud. And so that's allowed us to sort of keep growing the computational environment and be able to solve larger and larger problems. But it doesn't get us that sort of exponential improvement that you would really need to solve large PNP problems. Those problems still remain hard whether we try to solve them on a single computer or lots of computers working together. There's just even too many possibilities, even if you have tie all the computers all working together at all the same time.
You're listening to Science for the People. I'm here with Lance Fortnow, professor and chair of the School of Computer Science at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He's here talking about his book, The Golden Ticket, PNP and the Search for the Impossible. So you talk about in your book how parts of this problem were being worked on during the Cold War years, and it was approached a bit differently in the Western world than it was in the Eastern world. Can you give us a little bit of that backstory as to how this problem developed in each area of the world?
You know, it's kind of a neat story because there really was this separation of science in general between the East and the West, and, you know, in these days before the Internet, there was very little communication. And it could take a very long time for results from Russia to reach the U.S. or vice versa. So you see this sort of parallel development in computing in the 60s and the 70s coming out of the U.S. and coming out with Russia. On the U.S. end, it came out of a desire. We were actually building computers, and we were hitting a number of hard problems that we didn't have good algorithms to solve. And in 1971, a professor, Steve Cook at the University of Toronto, discovered that a certain specific kind of problem, something called Boolean formula satisfiability, seemed to be as hard as any other search problem there was. So Steve published this in a conference, and then about a year later, Richard Karp, a professor from Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley, realized that, you know, from this one problem, you can actually apply it to a whole slew of these other kinds of problems people were trying to solve. Problems like coloring a map, or finding the largest clique, or finding the shortest tour that visits lots of cities. You have a list of cities, you want to find the shortest tour that visits all of them. Those kinds of problems all turn out to be equivalent and all turn out to be as hard as any other problem in NP. Basically, if you could solve those problems efficiently, then you would have P equals NP and vice versa. And that led to an explosion in the U.S. in generating kinds of what kind of problems could be NP hard. In Russia, it was a kind of a more of a mathematical approach. It came from people trying to understand the nature of computing and information. And the Russia was also, in the U.S., where people work sort of independently. You know, scientists sort of work on their own. There's no sort of dominating organization. In Russia, things are, at least certainly back then, things were much more centrally coordinated and controlled. And they had a notion called perabor in Russia. Perabor means sort of a hard problem, hard search problem, that sort of thing. So there was the question about, you know, were there problems that were inherently difficult to solve? There was a Russian mathematician who claimed to have settled the problem. So he had some mathematical result that claimed to have settled this issue of perabor. And because of that, he sort of prevented a lot of other research from happening on the topic, kind of slowed down what happened in the Soviet Union, or I think they would have developed this theory much before the U.S. did. But there was this young student named Leonard Levin who was a bit of a rebel of his time and managed to actually sort of discover the same basic concepts that Steve Cook did in the U.S. at about the same time, around 1971, and published his results. But those results didn't make it into the U.S. until several years later. In fact, interesting story, Leonard Levin, because he was a bit of a troublemaker, he didn't get a PhD in Russia. He eventually managed to move to the U.S. He became a grad student for basically a year at MIT, where he just wrote up for a thesis everything he'd done in Russia and was granted a PhD, and then became a professor at Boston University, where he still is today. So it was a kind of a different approach, but yet yielding the same sort of basic question about P and NP, which kind of suggests that it really is a really natural problem if two kind of independent scientific organizations, you know, coming from two different angles, end up with the same sort of question.
Now, there's more than just a lot of prestige to cracking the P versus NP problem, isn't there? I understand there's a bounty on its head.
So the Clay Math Institute, after Fermat's last theorem was this famous problem from the 17th century that was solved by Andrew Wiles in the 1990s, and which gained a bit of notoriety. And so the Clay Math Institute decided it would be great to actually have a list of sort of famous math problems that, if they're solved, will offer a bounty for their reward. So they listed seven what they call millennium problems, because they published a list around 2000. So they listed sort of seven major math problems, one of which was, in fact, the P and NP problem. And it's the only one on the list that, first of all, it's the only one on the list that isn't named after a person, which is interesting. But it's also the only one on the list that I think has good, sort of clearly have practical value if it was solved in a certain way. You know, if we showed that P equals NP. And it sort of raised its stature, not just as, you know, a problem about, you know, what kind of computation can we solve, but actually says that, you know, this is not just an interesting computer science question, it's actually a fundamental mathematical question. And it has driven a lot of very notable mathematicians to really think about this problem, though it still remains, we still don't really have a great idea, and it's really lacking great ideas on how to actually solve the P and NP problem. How do we actually show that either P equals NP or P not equal NP still seems to be very difficult.
Right, because this isn't just a question of proving whether or not P equals NP, but it hasn't been proved that P doesn't equal NP either, which is perhaps even more challenging.
Right. In fact, like I said, most computer scientists tend to believe that they're different, that there is no magic algorithm that solves all these problems. But how do you show that no algorithm exists solve any of these problems? And there's, you know, an infinite number of potential computer programs out there. I need to somehow show that none of them can work. Not just any clever idea now, but no clever idea in the future will actually solve any of these problems. And how to do that is just very difficult. We just don't really have a great approach that would help us sort of eliminate all the possibilities. I mean, if you could show P equals NP, it would be a little bit easier because you just would need to come up with one algorithm that solves some of these problems. But since we kind of don't believe that algorithm exists, showing that no such algorithm exists seems quite challenging.
Always difficult to prove a negative.
Right. It's hard to prove non-existence. I mean, people have done it in other contexts. So, I mean, Fermat's last theorem is was an example of showing that nothing of a certain kind can exist. So it's not, like, impossible to do, but at the moment we don't have a good approach.
So have any of the other Millennium problems been solved?
Right, so one of them did. The Poincaré conjecture was solved a couple years ago. That's outside my area of expertise. I can't really explain it very well.
No problem. I'm actually just mostly trying to figure out, like, are these solvable problems?
You know, it's hard to tell. They were on the list because people, mathematicians, have been trying hard to solve them. But every now and then, hard problems get solved.
So what attempts have been made to solve the PNP problem? $1 million is a pretty significant bounty.
Honestly, I don't think the money is the big issue. You know, if you want $1 million today, there are probably a lot of easier ways to get $1 million. It'd be easier to just have an internet company, for example, or play the lottery. Yeah, I've just been trying to solve the NNT. So, but you know, still, I think the prestige factor certainly has driven lots of people to try to solve it. What attempts have been able to try to solve it? Well, people have tried to come up with algorithms. I mean, mostly, so far, none of them work. A lot of people try to do is say, well, if you have an algorithm that solves an NP kind of problem, it has to work a certain kind of way, and then try to say, then can we show that algorithms that have to be formed these kinds of problems are forced to do something that takes a long time? But those approaches usually get stuck because you can't really assume anything about how an algorithm would work. It could work in very strange, mysterious ways, attacking a problem not in a way you would expect to tackle that kind of problem. So those kinds of tricks don't work. You could try to break down an algorithm into its tiny little components. I mean, algorithms are just sort of computer code. Every algorithm can be broken down into a collection of very simple statements, you know, if thens and copies and, you know, setting things equal to each other, just very simple computational steps. In fact, you can break down anything into just basically ands and ors and nots. So very simple operations. And then what you could try to argue is that no single operation can do very much, and so you need a lot of operations to solve these NP problems. And there's been some success if you limit the kinds of operations you can do or limit how many operations you can do in a certain way, but still a long, long way from showing P not equal NP.
So gut instinct, do you think P equals NP or does P not equal NP?
My gut has always said P not equal NP.
Why?
The world would just be too clean if P equals NP. It'd be like removing friction from the world. Friction, you know, costs us a lot because it costs us a lot to do, but you could be, if you try to imagine a world without friction, you wouldn't be able to walk, you lose control of lots of things because everything would kind of
frictionless.
frictionless, right. Yeah. So you can imagine a world without any computational friction. It just doesn't seem like that's the kind. It seems like we just need complexity, and we need friction, and we need hardness to make the world the way it is, to keep it as a complex environment. So imagine that there's some, like, sort of algorithm out there that sort of makes everything easy. Just seems so fantastical that it shouldn't be true. It's certainly not a great scientific reason. I don't really have a great, you know, perfectly scientific reason. It's possible there's an algorithm out there that we're just too stupid to find, or it's just a bit more complicated than we're expecting. But the effects such an algorithm would have would just be oddly strange. It's just hard for me to believe it.
Do you think we'll ever really know? Do you think it's a solvable question?
Yes, I believe the problem is solvable, although I'm losing faith that I'm going to see a solution in my lifetime.
So this could be another sort of 300, 400-year open question.
Yeah, it could be 300 or 400 years. It could be one smart grad student coming up with an idea next year. It's just hard to really guess. But my guess is it's probably going to be a long struggle, is that someone will eventually realize that there's a path that will lead to a solution, and then there'll be a long slog along that path. So people will come up with these kind of partial results, and then finally someone will put it all together. And right now we're at the point where we don't even have that path. Forget trying to actually, you know, make our way along the path. So at least for now, it seems like the solution seems decades away, at least.
Lance, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me.
If you want to know more about Lance Fortnow, the P versus NP problem, or his book, The Golden Ticket, you can visit his website at goldenticket.fortnow.com, and you'll find that link on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca in our show notes. You'll also find links to our social media feeds, to subscribe to the show in iTunes, and to join the discussion by leaving a comment on our episode posts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.